Everybody's showing picture of hurricanes, so of course I have to show one as well. Well, and the reason I'm showing
your hurricane's bigger than Rupert's.
And well, that's, I was actually looking at Rupert's.
His were category two. Rupert's were category two.
My is really big, and of course this is sort of one of the biggest, obviously. But I mean, this is 1,500 kilometers. This is Yucatan. This is Florida. Well, what I like in this picture actually is not necessarily the hurricane itself, but look at those systems. I mean, you can clearly see a sense of rotation. I mean, the wind is definitely coming this way because look at Andy's blowing out. But the point is that these are probably quite big thunderstorms, possibly mesoscale systems. So if you're thinking about resolving and sort of, you know, understanding the physics of this beast and what's going on around, you really need to sort of use high resolution model, and because this is 1,500 kilometers. By the way, there are many interesting other things in this picture. This is in Florida, this is late afternoon, so you can see sort of the daytime convection of the land, sort of it's almost completely covered. And you can see a little bit on Yucatan, although this is earlier in the day, of course, and over there. So anyway, you can see in this picture there are some interesting structures there. But the point only is here that this is really a big thing, and if you're thinking about cloud resolving simulations of these things, so you need quite a few points to sort of cover this range of scale. Okay, and of course there is some microphysics going on in those systems. So this is basically sort of two issues that I would like this talk to be sort of focused upon. One is the range of scale. So the follow the previous picture suggests that we sort of have convective scale, let's say a kilometer up to synoptic, so it's like thousands of kilometers that you would like to cover in basically one model if you would like to do this sort of cloud resolving type of simulations. And the other thing that we haven't heard much about is actually the microphysics, which basically controls the thermodynamics. And you know that there are simple approaches that you can think about the moist adiabatic ascent, but eventually you have precipitation, you have ice processes, which sort of complicate the picture, and they, as I will try to convince you in my talk, they do play some role, as some very recent simulations suggest. So basically, the first part is how to deal with this, and the second one is sort of a new work that I've been doing over the last a year or year and a half with a postdoc to deal with microphysics, specifically with ice microphysics, because ice microphysics is difficult, and I think approaches that we've been using over the last 20 or 25 years are actually not very robust, in my view. Okay, so let's start with this thing. So the range of scale. So we know what people have been doing over the years. They've been truncating this range of scale by using convective parameterization. So not resolving convective clouds, shifting the emphasis into larger scales. But I would argue that this approach actually clogged numerical weather prediction for decades, because you know that's the only tool that we have. Of course, now what we can do is to use the model that can actually resolve convective motions, or let's say pretend that we're doing this, because you know there's a lot of dynamics that scale is smaller than 1 kilometer, but at least arguably with 1 kilometer grid length or few kilometers resolution, this will allow you to the non-hydrostatic motions to be represented in your model. Well, this is what I may call a brute force approach. In other words, we need a lot of computational resources to do it. And it's, of course, very expensive. And the question actually is there something in between? I think my pointer is slowly dying. Between
the mechanical pointer.
Is there another one? Oh, I cannot use those. So is there anything in between? And of course there is something, but otherwise I'd not be talking about that. And that's sort of the approach that we tried in a slightly different environment, in an environment of a climate model, which is something that I called cloud resolving convection parameterization. Dave Randall coined the term superparameterization, and the whole approach is now being quite often used. The term is being used to call it as a multi-scale modeling framework. And the idea is sort of really simple. If we have the large scale model, which is of course three-dimensional, and in a climate case, it's sort of like hundreds of kilometers, maybe a few hundreds of kilometers. In each column of this model, we will put a periodic domain two-dimensional cloud resolving model, which will have a horizontal grid length of, let's say, kilometer or two, and this model will sort of deal with the convective scale, and in the case of the climate model, also with the mesoscale, with the mesoscale organization. So in essence, this approach takes cloud-zone model and replaces convective parameterization with this model. So this is sort of the idea. This is X, Z, and of course you have columns of, you know, going up. So in each model you have, in each column you have two-dimensional model, which obviously has much higher resolution, and then it sort of represents the convective and mesoscale scales of motion. So it is a parameterization because you assume that this scale separation between large scale dynamics and cloud scale processes. Cloud scale means convective scale and mesoscale. And cloud models have periodic horizontal domains, so this is sort of like we've been using periodic models to look at, let's say, boundary layer development or maybe convective clouds. So this is sort of this type of approach. It's also very good for parallel computations because this models don't communicate directly, so it's sort of embarrassing the parallel approach. And also you can move a lot of physical or chemical, biological processes into cloud-zone models. So sort of it's a better representation. Or other way to say it, this is sort of like a physics coupler because these processes are actually working at small scale. So you couple, let's say, rain that falls out from the cloud and collect some chemical species on the way down and washes out. This everything happens at small scale. So this is a more natural framework to put this. Okay. Now, it's of course very expensive and given the computational time, let's say you can do either 1 day cloud dissolving simulations using atmospheric general circulation models or 1,000 years, a millennium long simulations using traditional climate model. And this approach is sort of in terms of orders of magnitude, sits right in between. So it's expensive if you think about the traditional climate model, but it's relatively cheap if you think about the sort of resolving all this convective and mesoscale, synoptic scale, and so on and so forth, and global scale in the HCF. So now, of course, hurricane is a sort of something that requires a mesoscale model. So natural question is, can you try?
I wanted to stop you on your last one. And the problem is that it's not quite true because the AGCM, there's no way you could. It's a time problem to run 1,000 years. You can't speed up time. You have to run 1 year after the other. So you can't put that on such a big. You can't use that on a big. You can't use that much computer resources. Can you? You'd have to use them in time.
Here is basically the estimate. If you calculate, for example, how much more expensive it is, you know, to come from here to here, it's about a factor of 1,000.
Yeah.
And then of course here, since you're using already a small time step for cloud resolving model, here the time step really doesn't come up.
No, but just the second to the third.
Right here.
Yeah, you couldn't. You can't do that.
You can or you cannot.
Could you?
Well, I mean, Dave, where is Dave? From your experience, about a couple hundreds, am I right? The first estimate that you sort of...
You can do a year with the middle option in about a day of walk.
Yeah. So...
And also with the first option, you could do a day in about a day. Yeah. One half year similar.
So, well, I mean, this is just basically...
Your point's made. I was just being...
You
can't do 1,000 years in a day, is sort of what I'm saying, just because you can't configure the calculations to fit on the computer in the way that you would like for the third one.
Well, I mean,
what is the time scale, 100 years? Or what can you do in a day with a classical?
About 20 years.
You can do 10, 100 years in your ocean.
Okay, but going into details, which are actually,
Okay. Well, it's a nice little poem.
The point is that it is expensive, but it's not that expensive if you think about sort of resolving basically everything. I mean, that's basically the point. Well, and the next sort of issue is, okay, well, can you try it in a mesoscale model? Because if you think about hurricane, can you try a mesoscale model with the same approach? Which by mesoscale model, I mean the model which has 10 and 50 kilometers. So basic idea is, that you will try to resolve mesoscale motions, and then just the convective scale will be handled by this approach, by a small two-dimensional cloud-dissolving model. So the idea basically is to run some simulations when you compare the simulations, when you resolve basically everything, a small simulation that you use high resolution, so there is no issues about periodic domains and so on and so forth for some subgrid regions in your model. And then you'd repeat the simulations using sort of this approach when you chop the domain in small pieces, and in each piece you have a periodic domain sort of along the model. So it seems relatively straightforward. So this is basically what is used to drive the model. So this is cooling and moistening that is prescribed to this sort of small mesoscale model. And that's a wind profile that you use. And this is a wind which has sort of some shears in it, so wind is changing if you go up. And that's important because this is sort of the environment in which the organized convection, mesoscale convective systems, and in this particular case, quarline, develop. And this, they will propagate at about 10 meters a second, so it could have inflow at low levels. And actually, this very particular shear profile comes from gate observations, and so this quarline looks a little bit different than sort of classical quarlines, which have just shear at low levels, and then not much shear left. But anyway, so this is sort of something that you use to drive the model. So you impose this sort of moistening and cooling on, let's say, 500 kilometer domain, and you let it go, and you see what develops. And so first, what you do, this is the cloud resolving simulation, so this is what we call a Knoller diagram, you heard this term before. So there is no gimmicks here, if you like, it's two-dimensional calculations. I will later show you three-dimensional calculations. So this is X and height in your model configuration. I'm showing results using basically X and time goes down. The left panel shows the surface precipitation, and this is cloud top temperature with this white being very cold. So basically what this figure shows is that after maybe 3-4 hours of basically nothing, some convection spontaneously develop, and after a few more hours develops into some sort of systems that there's few of them initially, and then there's only one that sort of keeps propagating through this periodic domain. And occasionally you have bursts sort of more upper tropospheric clouds, there's sort of more anvil, if you like, at some periods. And it sort of keeps doing this for about five days. And if you wonder how the system looks like, so this is this 512 kilometer domain. The setup actually comes from the paper that I was repeating the calculations. So this is sort of the convective scale. There is more convection here, and sort of and this beast with sort of changing shapes a little bit sort of keeps running in this shear environment. And if you actually calculate what sort of the speed is, it's sort of what you expect around 10 meters a second. And remember, this shear profile had about 20 meters a second maximum. So everything fits into what you expect to see. Now, this is cloud resolving, so there are no gimmicks here, but now what I will be doing, I will be chopping my domain in smaller pieces, and basically the same model will be used as the sort of outer model connecting those few columns, if you like, and then inside each of those small domains, I will have a small periodic domain cloud resolving model. And of course, these models will talk to each other only through the large scale. So idea is, is there a chance that I will reproduce the same of very similar structure, but if I do it using some? And of course, you know that this is the case, because otherwise they will be not telling me about. So at the bottom, this basically shows how this domain is being chopped. It's basically 32 columns in the outer model, and each column has 16 kilometers, and because grid is 2 kilometers, so I have just 8 columns in each of those small models stacked each to each other, next to each other. So as you see, the sort of things develop, I would argue, quite similarly as to the other case. You have some bubbling convection to begin with, and then you get sort of organization. And you can clearly see that these domains are periodic because these sort of things are propagating across it. But on the mesoscale, if you like, they look sort of more realistic. Are quite realistic, and actually you can see those sort of bursts of upper tropospheric cloudiness from time to time. So in my view, it looks good. Well, you can do the following thing. You can now try to chop the big domain in different pieces, and this is what this figure is showing up. And of course, now the outer model dynamics is sort of simple in a sense that it has just 8 columns, and each of those columns is quite big. As you can see now, you can clearly see the periodicity of these columns because the convective scale sort of is trapped inside and sort of morphs. But you can still see that this propagation a little bit slower than in the other case. I mean, still has some sort of similarity, if you like.
A little bit slower quantified as?
Well, let's say 7 rather than 10, or 7.5 rather than 10. So, I mean, yeah, there's definitely some impact. But again, this is 64 kilometers. So if you think about the middle scale model, that would be sort of the upper end, what people would use, maybe 40, 50 kilometers. And then, of course, they run off to also 32 kilometers, and that sort of fits in between these two. So if you think how these structures look like, so you've seen that one. This is the cloud dissolving result. And this is basically going from, yeah, this tells you 16 kilometers, 32, 64. So you can see that these domains are periodic, some signs of this sort of step structures. But I mean, you're basically looking at it sort of, kind of similar.
So this is
just a snapshot, just to
but
show
that's
you.
But remarkably, I mean, how does it, and it's only communicated, one domain only knows about the other through the mean state?
Yeah.
So I find that degree of continuity between the domains sort of more remarkable than I would have. Like,
but
how does the column at 256 to 384
which one?
Know where it is relative to the other columns? Because they only see the mean state.
Well, yeah, but the mean state, so for example, if you move cloud water, you move it from one domain to the other, and then the other domain does something with it. And
there is communication between those, the subcolumns.
But just
communication by a coarse finite difference scheme on the coarse mesh,
yes.
Right?
Yeah. So you're just moving averages, if you like.
Okay.
You don't. That's why, for example, you have those sort of jumps here or those steps here, because typically when you move a little bit, it basically will evaporate
so
in one time step.
So are you doing the following thing of speeding up time a lot in your small boxes and compared to the time steps of your course?
No, basically step with the time scale that is dictated by the cloud scale model, and from time to time you basically average fits and calculate large scale tendencies.
And your large scale averages are just done by the same numerical code you had running anyway as a finite difference code.
Yeah.
So
Corson.
Or that you can communicate through reflection or wave propagation on the course mesh, right?
Yeah, I mean, so if you have waves that move things around, this will, for example, produce the temperature tendencies on the neighboring grid. So whether you have some wave dynamics or physical propagation of whatever cloud water, I mean, these two work as well. Yeah. So now, of course, this approach immediately translates into three-dimensional system because this is what this picture is supposed to show. Because now, if I have a three-dimensional model, which is sort of here, and it has 20 by 20 columns. It's not exactly 512, it's 520 kilometers, it doesn't matter. And this is just a snapshot, so this is surface precipitation, this is cloud pot temperature. And the idea basically is that before I had one dimensional, sort of two-dimensional squamer, now I have a sort of three-dimensional squamer, so it should do basically similar things as a two-dimensional squamer, and it should have some structure along the sort of perpendicular direction, and that's basically what the slide is showing, that there is some structure. And again, each of those columns, those small boxes, have a small two-dimensional cloud dissolving model. So this is surface precipitation and the cloud pot temperature. So it still propagates in a similar pattern, and this is what this one is showing. So now I'm showing surface precipitation, and if I'm not wrong, this is just average north-south, if you like, across this quorum line, whereas the cloud pot temperature is just a snapshot at any given time. So it basically shows you that this quorum line sort of propagates as in the other one, but the point is that this is now a three-dimensional simulation. So you get on a mesoscale you have 20 by 20 points, and each of those columns has a small 10 columns two-dimensional model. So I think it sort of looks pretty good.
How are they oriented?
So the 2D is oriented sort of
oriented.
Yeah, east west. So I mean, of course, you can ask me how I should orient them and this and that, and I take all the criticism, no problem with this. I don't know how to do it, but of course you can do it in many different ways.
So these are kind of developed, mature squall lines in your gate phase 3, your old work with Moncrief and Chao-Shing Wu. you had this very nice regime where you went from scattered to an organized squall line,
yes.
and it failed
yeah.
because the shear, the ambient shears changed their structure, etc.
So
that's a really tricky test for you to run.
Well, actually, that was done.
With this coarse resolution.
If you look at our original paper with Piotr, 1998 paper, this is exactly the test that we used. Was this the 7 day of cave simulation? Although we didn't explore it very, but I mean, you can clearly see that you get those. A lot of rain, not propagating a lot, then you have a phase when there is falling.
So do you predict the active and organized phases of convection reasonably well?
Yeah, we haven't looked sort of very carefully to document that, but I mean...
It's worth revisiting, actually, with systematic changes.
Perhaps, yes. So, okay, so now some comments. So first of all, you may think, well, these results are sort of not surprising because NWT models, which sort of use horizontal grid lengths of tens of kilometers, have been simulating organized convection for decades using basically traditional convection parameterization. So what I've done here, and this is just one of the examples, I'm not sure that this is one of the first papers that actually talk about that, or maybe there were papers before. This is the one that I was aware of. So this is sort of like continental convection of the US. Some extreme weather type of simulations. Then if this is sort of my corner on hurricanes, because I think this is what I'm supposed to talk about. So since such models that use traditional convective parameterizations also been used to simulate hurricanes with quite success, I would argue that superparameterization has a potential to improve hurricane modeling in mesoscale models. In other words, you can try the same approach in a sort of mesoscale model with 20, 30 kilometers, and I would be surprised if this approach would not work. Of course, you may want to think how you would like to align those two-dimensional models. In some of my other simulations, I was making models aligned in different ways, and I know that the same is sort of happening in work within CMAP, where in a climate model, they try different orientations, arguing why you want to have one or not the other, so on and so forth. But I don't want to go to into this area, but that's basically the sort of middle approach between sort of parameterized convection and cloud dissolving models. So there is this third approach that I would argue in a modeling of hurricanes, somebody should try. I don't know enough about hurricanes, how to really sort of spin up a model to produce a hurricane, but I think it has some potential.
What exactly do you mean by improved hurricane modeling? I mean, what are you improving?
We come into the second part. We've been talking about microphysics. So let's, for example, talk about microphysics in hurricane modeling. Okay, because I would argue that this approach, that also is my motivation. This approach is very powerful because arguably it's a better framework to put microphysics in because you're really resolving some of the relevant scales. Whereas I'm at least not aware of convection scheme that takes some microphysical consideration, except maybe for your case scheme, which has some relatively simple microphysical consideration, but the microphysics is typically put aside in convective scheme, and then is dealt with in a mesoscale model. And if you, okay, this comment not directly related to what I want to talk about, but I perhaps should make it. Remember, in a mesoscale model with parameterized convection, the microphysics is actually done on sort of mesoscale model. Here, everything, in my approach, everything is done on cloud scale model. So if there is advection of cloud water, let's say, from box to box, it's done through the large scale model, but all microphysics happens on a cloud dissolving model. There are some tendencies that are being inputted into the small scale model. And I think that this is maybe an important difference between how this is done in the parameterized convection and sort of this type of approach. Because ultimately, cloud scales, when the rain falls, even if it falls horizontally from the buildings, it falls on a small grid. Okay, well, so now, the next half an hour, let's talk about ice microphysics and cloud microphysics. And somebody may say, should we care about microphysics? Well, this is interesting because there are now some studies which actually show that cloud microphysics has some impact on hurricane dynamics. And I basically, using a poster of student, my former colleague of, not former, my colleague of me from Urbana-Champaign, that basically showed exactly that. And it's sort of a side note, is that this simulation suggests to some people that maybe we should go and see hurricanes.
What's the SAL? What's
it,
maybe on Hale?
It's okay, it's the
Sahara
aerosol layer. So it's basically the dust that being blown off Sahara ends up in the Atlantic.
And the mathematicians in the audience don't know that CCN means condensation, nuclear.
That kind of condensation. But I mean, it really doesn't matter because this is really detailed. The point, the main point
was
is
the
here.
Point, it was CNN.
Anyway, but I mean, it's really not important, but I mean, what microphysics is, I think people realize, is those microscale processes that affect formation of cloud droplets and ice crystals in clouds. And remember that the condensation happens because you produce liquid phase or ice phase. This is where the heating is released. And depending how you do it, in terms of those microscale processes, has some impact on the dynamics, apparently, at least in these simulations. So basically, what I'm showing here is the evolution of the maximum wind and minimum pressure, I guess, in the center of the hurricane, depending on some of those microphysical considerations. So basically, what happens in the simulation is you prescribe those small particles, a number of them, that affect the microphysical processes. And basically, depending whether you have sort of typical clean aerosol like over the ocean, my pointer is sort of playing games with me, or whether you have this sort of enhanced layer of more aerosols beneath 5 kilometers, as you can clearly see, the sort of more dirty the air gets, the weaker the hurricane is. And you know, don't ask me why it is so. I don't think they understand what's going on. But this is basically the picture, that you have a very strong and small eye, and then you get more pollution. You're getting sort of bigger eye, not as organized wall cloud, as far as I can tell. So this is just a snapshot, and this is the evolution of I think, what is that, probably radar reflectivity. So anyway, so.
Should we repeal the clean air act?
Yeah. Well, you know,
Africa.
But I mean, you know, I'm not joking. Based on those results, you know, I don't know, I will not use any names, you know, that gentleman is proposing to fly and see the air around hurricanes because that's the way to make hurricanes weaker. I mean, you know, the only reason I'm saying that is that there are some parts of this, you know, beast that we don't understand, and impact of microphysics is one of them. So because of that, I decided that sort of part of this modeling sort of advertisement or modeling overview, I should tell you a little bit about more thermodynamics and how thermodynamics is done in clouds. I'm not sure whether that was beyond expected me, but since we're really doing some interesting work on ice parameterization, I thought that I explain how this is done as a part of sort of cloud modeling in general. So first of all, the moist air is treated as a perfect gas. I mean, no surprise there. We know that phase changes that release latent heat and then, of course, produce condensation, either liquid or solid. So let me read it. Okay, so this phase changes produce various cloud particles. Of course, in the satellite picture, you just see white cloud, but it's white because it has numerous either water droplets or ice crystals. And there are different particles, and I will show in a second. Now, the condensed phase is treated as a continuous medium. Another way to say it is that we use density of, let's say, cloud droplets or raindrops to represent its presence. Since usually you have quite low mass loading factor, if you like, or mass fraction, so in other words, the weight of droplets comparing to the weight of air that is holding it is typically very small. It's sort of typically less than 10 grams per kilogram of air. This is sort of the mixing ratio that we use. We don't need to do some sort of multi-phase approaches. We don't need to treat those particles separately. So this is like a continuous medium type of approach. And typically there is a mixing ratio, as I said, that is used. And just because when you take the air particles moving up, this mixing ratio variable, which is just the density of those condensed particles to the density of air, doesn't change because basically the whole particle expands. So this is sort of a convenient variable. Now, long range microphysics is relatively straightforward because clouds, water clouds, are typically very near water saturation. In other words, if you take air particles near the ground and move it, let's say, 2 or 3 kilometers up, and you ask, okay, how much condensation I got through this sort of process, it's very accurately to say that it's just to be at water saturation. If the air upward velocity is very strong, you may diverge from that, but it's typically not large. It's fraction of a percent, and the reason is that there is always enough those cloud condensation nuclei, those small aerosol particles, soluble particles that initiate condensation. So the warm rain part, as we call it, which means cloud water, drizzle, and rain, is relatively straightforward to do. Now it's simple to do if you only carry how much mass you move. If you would like to know the particle sizes, the situation is more complicated. And it's particularly very complicated if you start thinking about ice processes. And it's complicated for the ice processes because there are just many different types of ice particles. So starting from those relatively small ones that are basically growing by diffusion of water vapor, and these, all of those are examples of those particles. And sometimes you get snowflakes, so crystals like that, and they can sort of interlock with each other and produce sort of nice snowflakes. I don't think in this part of the world you see quite often them, but anyway, all any of those. The other mechanism that these crystals, when these crystals are formed and they fall through a cloud, they start to collect supercooled water droplets. So if you have a situation where you have ice crystals falling through the cloud that collects that contains small cloud droplets, these droplets will stick to crystals and they freeze, and this process is called riming. So these are examples of different crystals grown by riming. And of course, if you have a lot of those crystals attached, at some point you lose identity of this diffusionally grown crystal. You just have something which we call gropers. So in other words, there are so many of those small droplets attached that you don't longer see what is really inside. And of course, so this is small, this is a little bit bigger, this is not to scale, and this is a hailstone, which involves basically the same physical processes. The only difference is that you have so much liquid water attached to it that sometimes it's not enough cooling to freeze them. So anyway, so this is sort of just the example of complications we have with ice physics. So simple ice schemes, or relatively simple ice schemes that were developed, let's say, 20, 25 years ago, typically involve this sort of logic that you create small ice crystals, then these crystals grow and you have snow, and then you have gropel or hail to basically represent this sort of sequence of growth mechanisms. And I always had sort of doubt about this sort of partitioning. I mean, of course, we know that you can find the small ice and snow and gropel in the cloud, but putting those artificial boundaries is really not something that you would do. And it basically follows the approaches proposed 20 plus years ago. And the motivation really comes from the warm rain processes, and this is what these panels are supposed to be illustrating. The idea is to be looking at the concentration in logarithmic scale, typically, and size of particles, and time goes along the thread axis. And the idea here is that you start, this is the spectrum of droplets initially, and then when you basically let, and these droplets are falling, so the bigger droplets are catching smaller droplets, and when there is a collision, they sort of are bigger, so they're growing even faster, and so on and so forth. And as the time goes on, these droplets are producing the second peak, which eventually moves away, and those are drizzle and rain drops. So if you think about the clouds that is sort of produce already some drizzle drops, it will sort of natural. It has these two different peaks. This will be drizzle or rain peak, and this will be cloud water peak. And again, this is sort of 10, maybe 20 microns, and then this peak goes through sort of quickly, so this sort of dip, and then produces hundreds of microns or maybe a couple millimeters raindrop. So this partitioning is sort of natural, because that's sort of the physics, how the sort of system evolves through collision coalescence. So this is complicated diagram, but it basically, it sort of shows how the thermodynamics, how these microphysical processes are typically done in those schemes. So you have water vapor, cloud water, rainwater, and I showed you this part. So this is the separation between cloud water and rain. And now on this sort of cold microphysics, ice microphysics, you have formation of cloud ice, and if conditions are right, then you produce snow through some conversion mechanism, if you like, and of course snow will fall out and collect other crystals, and may also collect supercooled liquid water if it's available, and eventually will produce droplets. So this is sort of the ice part with this cloud ice, snow, and global path, if you like. And I always had some worries that this is really not the way we should model it, for the very simple reason is that when you think about diffusional growth of small ice crystals, they basically grow gradually, and the transition from cloud ice into snow is very, really, really gradual. It's not that you hit a threshold and then everything sort of moves into the snow category. So then the question, does this approach make sense? Perhaps I should skip this argument why it doesn't, but I mean, for those interested, you can welcome to read it. Let me then quickly go to the approach that I sort of had in mind for quite a while, and actually got into doing it with a postdoc that is working with me. So the idea is relatively simple, is that let's assume that you predict three variables. You predict number of crystals, so this is basically you move those crystals around and they can fall out, so this is the terminal velocity. And of course you will have some sources and sinks that I don't want to sort of write them out here to not to complicate the picture. So this is basically the number concentration of ice crystals. Now, typically, you would predict mixing ratio of different ice particles. Let's do something different. Let's predict two mixing ratios. One would be the mixing ratio that you grow by diffusion of water vapor. So let's call it QVP. So this is the mass of the ice inside your box of your model that you grow by diffusion of water vapor. And then predict the other one, that is the mass that you predict by riming, in other way, by accretion of supercooled liquid water. So this is diffusional growth and this is accretional growth. So at any given moment inside your model grid box, you have three variables that basically contain information about ice field. One is the number concentration, so you know how many particles you have. And the other one is the total mass of ice, which is distributed into two mixing ratio. This is not my phone, I always switch it now. So if you think about the growth by diffusion, so you have a small sort of droplet that freezes and begins to grow by diffusion of water vapor, and it may grow by aggregation, so crystals are sort of sticking to each other to produce snowflakes. This is actually represented, simple to represent in this model, because you predict numbers, you predict mass, so if number doesn't change, the mass changes, then the mean size, of course, growing up. If you have aggregation, which means crystals sticking together, and you don't change mass because, for example, they do not grow anymore by diffusion, but they just sort of stick to each other, then of course you will have the number that is changing. So this conversion from small ice crystals into snow is sort of easily represented by just having these two variables. Now, this one is also very important because, as I told you, crystals, those ice particles grow by collecting supercooled water droplets. So this is just the first phase of growth when they grow by diffusion. If there is liquid water, the small droplets will start to stick to each other, to this crystal. And the important point is that this these growths, okay, and the third one is, of course, growth when everything is filled in and then we'll be growing up. But the important point is that if you have this sort of priming that slowly progresses, the size of the crystal is actually given by the diffusional growth, if you like, or the mass that is accumulated by the diffusional growth, and the rest is coming from the droplet. So this partitioning between diffusional and accretional, as we call it, growth, or growth by priming, allows you to build a relatively simple but consistent framework to grow from very small ice crystals to droplet. In other words, the ratio between these two will tell you how much mass is grown by diffusion, and that's what decides the size of the crystals in this process of sort of getting into droplet, but not quite there. And so that's why the sort of having these two is important. So now the rest sort of everything falls out. It's sort of tricks that cloud microphysics is doing sort of on a daily basis. You assume some size distributions, which is typically what we call in cloud physics the gamma distribution, so the number of particles depends on the size in the following way. So it will basically be three parameters. So the number of droplets or ice crystals that you have, this is the total number. So of course this is the thing that you predict. The sum of these two is the mass. So if this is your size distribution and this is the mass of the crystals, that sort of these two will give you that. So of course there is three parameters, two equations. So we need to come up. We need one more relationship between those parameters, and this basically comes from the diagnostic relationship that ties this parameter mi here with the parameter lambda. It's basically based on observation. So after that, everything is relatively simple. There are a few things that I can explain, but I really don't think I should, because that's really going into details. But the idea being that having this sort of coherent relationships. Now, one thing that I should point out is that typically the mass and the projected area of crystal when it falls out, because that's needed for collection, there is basically a lot of data from laboratory or from field observations that this parameterization is using, as the other parameterization as well. So that's sort of what is interesting. That's why I want to go quickly through the results, because I don't think I have time to explain it. Perhaps one thing that I should explain is that having this Rhine mass fraction, basically if this is zero, we know this is the crystal grown by diffusion. If this tends to be one, which means that the Rhining is sort of gets most of the mass, it's sort of global or hay. And somewhere in between, those are Rhine crystals that an important point is that the size is actually given by the mass grown by diffusion, which is basically 1 minus half times the mass of the crystal. So it's a relatively straightforward formula, but it's really sort of ties things nicely. And there are some other things you have to, having this distribution, you actually, and assuming that this ranked fraction applies to the entire spectrum of droplets, you have to make some additional assumptions. Dividing the spectrum into different sizes, so we have sort of very small, sort of like frozen small droplets, something that we call dense non-spherical lines. Those are typically particles that don't grow by timing because they are just too small. And then you have droplet, and eventually when you have partly Rhine crystals, because when you have a very large crystal, it will not be droplet yet, so this boundary will sort of move. So, I mean, you can build relatively simple, relatively straightforward framework. One thing which is interesting here, which I think I have to stress, is that depending on this Rhine fraction, the fault velocity of crystals will gradually change, and those kinks in those lines basically represent, this is just for a couple given conditions, if you like, represent some changes in some of those formulas that we use to describe behavior of fallout of what we call a terminal velocity of ice crystals. But the point is that depending on this Rhine fraction, this sort of gradually changes from velocities typical from small ice crystals that don't have Rhine on it to something that we know applies to global, which sort of so this fallout of precipitation from the cloud is sort of gradually given by your model. So We applied it to a simple test. I don't think I want to go into details. The problem at this point is basically showing that it's sort of working and it's doing what we expect it to do in this sort of really idealized case. It produces various types of crystals depending where you are. The precipitation arrives at the ground in different forms at different times. So it sort of behaves in a way that that is sort of common sense would dictate. So I'm not sure whether you learn much from that, but I thought it's sort of interesting to sort of show where we're going in terms of microphysics parameterization. So just some concluding thoughts. I do believe that superparameterization can be a useful approach for convective parameterization problem in a mesoscale model, which typically we're talking about models between 10 and 50 kilometers. And it does provide a significantly cheaper alternative to fully cloud-resolving or convective permitting mesoscale model. I should add that if you think about this, if you're using, let's say, 20 kilometer grid in a mesoscale model, you will be basically an order of magnitude cheaper comparing to a cloud resolving model. So if you think about this, this sort of number will come up. So it's not sort of three orders of magnitude as in the climate model, but it's still a factor of 10, roughly speaking. Now, about cloud microphysics, maybe I should say it at the beginning, but I think this is my sort of feeling that the cloud microphysics will soon replace the convection parameterization as a top priority area in modeling of moist large-scale atmospheric dynamics.
Just to make sure I understand, you're talking, so if you have a model with 1 kilometer or 250 meter resolution that you're running, then your parameterization scale starts seeing details of microphysics. Is that your point?
You're talking about the
point two here. When you you made this strong statement, cloud microphysics will soon replace the parameterization.
Well, what
maybe only to me it seems only in the models of very high resolution.
Well, what I really meant is that if you think at NWP models of let's say 10, 15 years ago, these were, let's say, of a continental US, sort of like MM5 model that some people may know. These models were run with convective schemes, and of course, showing some sensitivity or significant sensitivity to what sort of convective scheme you use. These days, WOLF, let's say, this new generation weather and research forecast model, is using, let's say, 4 kilometers of a continental US. Probably within a year or two, this model will be run at maybe 2, maybe 1.5 kilometers.
Yeah.
What I'm saying, the convection parameterization in a model like that is no longer the sort of the key area that people worry about. And what will be the key area will be cloud microphysics, because there's already quite strong signals that if you use those different schemes that people have, and you look, for example, at some maps in terms of radar reflectivity comparing to observations, what happens typically, the simulations look quite similar to each other, but often look different than what observations are showing. So basically my message is that the parameterization of some of those very, very small scale processes will, in my view, become the sort of the most important area of research, in my view. And I guess you can probably read it already. I mean, I think that microphysics is the key because it brings in such a complication of, and not only complication, but also there is still considerable lack of understanding of some of these processes. And I would argue that we need to work more on cloud microphysics as well. So I guess I will stop at this point.